Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 356 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in today's podcasts, I'm going to title this the Clutch UTI Podcast. The Clutch UTI Podcast. It's going to be a very high-yield podcast. It's going to be short and sweet, but we're going to talk about a lot of really high-yield information. The first thing I want to say, though, is if you're taking the USMLE Step 2 CKA or Step 3 exams, or the Complex Level 2 or 3 exams, around the end of January or February, I do have a 24-hour Step 2 CKA, Step 3, and also applies to Complex course taking place from the 25th to the 20th of January 2022. It's from 7 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mountain Standard Time each day. That's like 9 to 3 p.m. Eastern. And then I have an MBME Test Taking Strategies course. I'm on the 24th of January 2022. So if you're interested, it's from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Mountain Time. That's like 4 to 6:30 p.m. Eastern. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website to reserve a spot. I'll give you some more details on payment once payments are made. The spot is reserved. Again, I've had tons of people take these courses. They've done extremely well on the exams. And then, next year, sometime next year, this is a goal. I have a USMLE school that I'll love to start next year. Something I'm thinking about. My vision is something that is going to be like just insanely comprehensive, totally comprehensive for the USMLEs, especially Step 2 CKA, Step 3. Just a school idea, but just something I'm thinking about. We'll see. Okay, so let's just jump right into it. So, we know UTIs come in two flavors, right? There is, at least for the most part on MBME exams, there's cystitis, which is a bladder infection, and then there's pyelonephritis, which is a kidney infection. Now, the thing is, cystitis can actually be something that they can present on MBME exams as a cause of urge incontinence, right? Because many times when people have a bladder infection, they have this urge to pee, right? So literally, instead of putting cystitis as an answer, they can just make up a question where in some way, shape, or form, urge incontinence is the right answer for cystitis, because it literally will cause urge incontinence. It's just more of an acute nature. After you treat the infection, the problem goes away. So what are some classic symptoms, our friends at the MBMEs love to throw for people that have UTIs? Well, they'll have like pain with urination, especially again, if we're talking about cystitis, they'll have like pain with urination, they'll have like urinary frequency, they'll have urinary urgency, right? Like increased urinary frequency, a lot of urinary urgency, again, urge incontinence. For pylo, they'll put more flank pain, fever, costal vertebral angle tenderness, stuff like that. Right now, one thing I guess I want to point out again as we make integrations across this podcast is that our friends at the MBMEs, when you see an elderly person with a UTI, many times, I didn't say all the time, but many times they love to give those people delirium, they love to give them altered mental status. And with the elderly, again, especially with UTIs, they love this whole concept of anticholinergics causing problems, right? Remember, anticholinergics will make you not urinate. If you don't urinate, you're going to have urinary stasis. If you have urinary stasis, you're going to get a UTI, right? So they give you a question about a lady has altered mental status, low abdominal pain, old lady, and she's been taking over-the-counter cold medicine. Again, think of diphenhydramine. It has very powerful anticholinergic activity, basically cause your detrusor muscles to not work, right? You're going to have urinary stasis. You're going to get a UTI from that. And then, remember, in terms of causes, right? So what is the most common cause of most UTIs? Well, it's E. coli, right? E. coli is the most common cause of UTIs. The second most common cause actually is Staph saprophyticus, right? Especially in a sexually active young female. But again, there are some other epidemiological things our friends at the MBME is going to target these days, right? So like if, for example, you look at hospital-acquired infections, we think of hospital-acquired pneumonia and things like that. Actually, the most common hospital-acquired infection, believe it or not, the most common cause of nosocomial infections is a catheter-associated UTI, right? So most people get UTI. Like if you see a person get an infection while in the healthcare system, or like a nursing home, it's going to be a UTI. That's the most common, right? And I guess if they give you a UTI, again, I'm just trying to make this thing more scenario-based because I feel like that's where you get a lot more from this. If you get a, if you see a person getting a UTI and the urine pH is super basic, it's like 8.5, 9, 9.5, like just super crazy basic. You know, I want you to think of a urease positive bug, right? So something like Proteus, something like, especially Proteus mirabilis, something like Klebsiella, something like Uroplasma urolyticum. They love to test Uroplasma urolyticum a lot these days on the USMLE exams. And also think of Staph saprophyticus. Staph saprophyticus also happens to be urease positive. Again, remember, Proteus especially really loves to cause these, you know, they'll show you like an X-ray image of a person's kidneys, and boom, you see like this white stuff that looks like almost like antlers or whatever it's called. If you see that, where you're thinking of struvite stones, right? Remember, those are your magnesium and ammonium phosphate stones, right? Sometimes they call them staghorn calculi, right? So again, in our current MBME world, one thing that has been important, I'll say probably over the last like 18 months, are risk factors. The MBME is the love risk factors. You should expect to see many risk factor questions on your exams. Again, I have podcasts for those, right? Episode 37, 97, 184. But let's talk about risk factors for a person getting a UTI. Well, I mean, female anatomy. Remember, if you're a woman, your urethra is pretty short and your urethra is also pretty close to the anus. That's not a problem that men have, unfortunately, right? So it's almost like the bacteria is almost like instead of having to travel from the East Coast to the West Coast to cause UTIs in men, for women, the bacteria can just travel from the West Coast to the West Coast to cause UTIs, right? So females, you know, you have a short urethra. Your urethra is pretty close to the anus, which has a ton of bugs. That's going to increase your risk of having UTIs. If you have diabetes, your urine is very sweet. Since your urine is very sweet, that's going to cause a bacteria to grow, essentially organizing a party for the bacteria. That's going to cause problems. Remember the SGLT2 inhibitors, those diabetes drugs, right? So canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, and empagliflozin. So those drugs, they inhibit you from reabsorbing glucose at your at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule, right? So again, that's going to make your urine sweet. That's going to cause problems. And don't forget, those SGLT2 inhibitors specifically, because they put so much sugar in your urine, there'll be so much sugar in your perineum, that can cause a very life-threatening infection of the perineum, right? Like literally like necrotizing fasciitis of the perineum. That's what we call Fournier's gangrene. Fournier's, F-O-U-R-N-I-E-R, Fournier's, and you know, apostrophe and an S, Fournier's gangrene. That can be something you may see in a person that has is taking an SGLT2 inhibitor. And then remember, if you're pregnant, right? When you're pregnant, you have this wonderful placenta in your uterus. That placenta is making a ton of progestin. Progestin is a very big time smooth muscle relaxant. If you relax smooth muscles, especially in the urethra, that's going to cause urinary stasis. You're going to get a UTI from that. And the thing is, as you get older, you're also going to get more UTIs, right? Well, I mean, young females, but especially if you're sexually active, you're going to be getting a lot of UTIs. But as a woman gets older, right, that predisposes her to UTIs. Because the thing is, estrogen actually helps you maintain your vaginal flora, right? And, you know, if you have a certain kind of vaginal flora, it's almost like a survival of the fittest. It protects you against having a UTI, right? But once you kind of hit menopause, your ovaries go away or, you know, become non-functional, you don't make any estrogen anymore. That's going to cause a lot of problems with maintaining that vaginal flora. You're going to get a UTI, right? Another risk factor for UTI is a person that has had a stroke or some kind of spinal cord injury, right? Especially people that have spinal cord injuries, right? They have bladder dysfunction. Again, if your bladder doesn't work well, you're going to have a urinary state. You're not going to be draining the bladder well. You're going to have urinary stasis. That's going to cause a UTI, right? And remember, these people that have had spinal cord injury, they tend to use catheters a lot to evacuate, to get rid of their urine, right? So that's going to, again, predispose them to having a UTIs, right? In fact, the most common kind of infection in people with spinal cord injury is a UTI, believe it or not, right? And then also, if you're a guy and you have BPH, right? If your prostate gets super big and then it kind of squishes your urethra and you're not able to drain your bladder well, again, that's going to cause urinary stasis. That's going to cause a UTIs. Again, I think as you're seeing, three things principally cause you to get UTIs. You either have urinary stasis, that's probably like the big one. The second one is your urine is very sweet because you're a diabetic or you're taking some of these oral hypoglycemics that dump a ton of sugar in your urine. Or you can just have anatomical problems, right? Like BPH, female anatomy, stuff like that, right? So how do we treat UTIs? Actually, maybe in fact, let me talk about this. How do you diagnose UTIs, right? So in general, UTIs are a clinical diagnosis, right? Especially bladder infections. For a person has like the classic signs and symptoms of a bladder infection or pyelonephritis, you don't have to do any kind of diagnostic testing. Just go ahead and proceed to treatment. I'll talk about how to treat it in a bit. But there are I would say, few populations of people where you should consider doing some testing. Now, what's that some testing? Well, that some testing is a urinalysis and urine culture, right? Urinalysis and culture. That's for a bladder infection and also for a kidney infection for pylo. But for pylo, in certain populations, testing also means getting a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis with IV contrast, right? So we'll talk about some of those populations. So again, I said in general, if a person presents with the classic signs and symptoms of pylo or the classic signs and symptoms of cystitis, just make your clinical diagnosis, go ahead and treat, right? So how do we go ahead and treat? Well, the way we go ahead and treat for a bladder infection is you can use Bactrim, you can use trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, or you can use like nitrofurantoin, right? Or you can even use amoxicillin clavulanic acid. That's actually the correct answer, believe it or not, on some MBM exams. You can use cephalosporin if you want. Those are your first line agents. Now, let me tell you this. Your second line agent for UTIs in general on MBM exams is a fluoroquinolone. If you see any of these other options I've mentioned in an answer stem as among your answer choices, and you see a fluoroquinolone, pick all these other things first before you pick a fluoroquinolone, right? Because again, fluoroquinolones, they can cause a lot of problems, right? They can cause tendonitis, they can cause you to rupture your Achilles, right? And they cause problems at the level of the neuromuscular junction, right? So they kind of worsen myasthenia gravis. That's kind of a similar case as aminoglycosides, right? Remember, aminoglycosides and neuromuscular blocking agents, fluoroquinolones, again, they cause neuromuscular junction dysfunction, right? So if a person has myasthenia gravis, you should not be putting those people on fluoroquinolones or aminoglycosides like gentamicin on an MBME exam. That would not be a great idea. But if you don't see any of these other options and just see a fluoroquinolone, you can pick a fluoroquinolone. That's perfectly fine on your exams, right? Now, so that's for bladder infection. But for pyelonephritis on MBME exams, though, you can either treat it with a ceftriaxone or treat it with a fluoroquinolone, or you treat it with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, okay? So that's how you treat pylo on MBME exams. And most times, you know, pylo, you're going to give IV antibiotics versus cystitis, where you're going to do more oral antibiotics, right? So who are some of the populations where you're like, okay, let's make sure we do diagnostic testing, right? Let's get this urinalysis, urine culture, and then if it's a kidney infection, like in addition to your urinalysis and culture, we're like, oh, let's get a CT scan. These are people that have like complicated UTIs, right? So people that are like diabetic, that's one classic group. People that are immunocompromised, that's another classic group, like HIV patients. People that are pregnant, right? Males, if males get UTIs, that's a big cause for concern. That is a massive cause for concern. You got to do something there, right? So again, those are just some key populations to kind of keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? And again, one other thing I will say about UTIs as I begin to wrap up is, remember, if a woman is not pregnant and she has no symptoms, but you check her urine and urine contains a lot of bacteria, you don't have to treat. That's what we call asymptomatic bacteriuria, right? You don't treat asymptomatic bacteriuria. But if a woman is not pregnant and she has symptoms, she's symptomatic, then you're going to treat, right? Now, that case does not apply with pregnancy. If you're pregnant, it doesn't matter. You're symptomatic, not symptomatic, it literally doesn't matter. Asymptomatic bacteria, even in pregnant women, is treated, right? And remember, in treatment, in pregnant people, you have to do that diagnostic test. You got to get the urinalysis, got to get the urine culture. You probably want to go ahead and avoid the CT scan so you don't get in trouble with, you know, radiation to the fetus. You don't want to do that. But, you want to do a urinalysis, urine culture in pregnant women. You want to treat them, usually with like 7 days of therapy. You don't need to know that for your exams. But after that, you need to do a test of cure. You need to do a test of cure. Now, the reason that OB-GYN doctors are very aggressive, or the MBME expects you to be very aggressive with UTIs during pregnancy, is that they're actually a risk factor for preterm labor, right? And the thing is, in pregnant women, the only drugs you should really be using for UTIs are nitrofurantoin or cefalexin. You can use any of those drugs, right? Don't use Bactrim in a pregnant woman. You don't want to be killing the fetus, right? I mean, Bactrim is literally like a folate synthesis inhibitor. That doesn't sound like a very pristine idea for a pregnant woman. Now, just some other quick things they may throw in with UTIs on exams that can get people in the wrong direction is, if you notice that a person has a UTI and, you know, you do a gram stain of their urine, you don't see any bugs, or you do a culture, you don't grow anything, and it's a young sexually active female, I want you to think of a urethritis potentially as the infection, right? Usually it's going to be like chlamydia on an MBM exam, or you may also see the bug Mycoplasma genitalium. Those are the two bugs they classically test with these antecedents on MBM exams. In those circumstances, all you're given is doxycycline or azithromycin. Now, let me tell you this. The biggest risk factor for UTIs in a young sexually active female is actually sexual intercourse. This is actually very high, you ought to know, right? You see many women, that's why when they get married, the first few months of marriage, they're getting a ton of UTIs, right? Because they're just super, I mean, most people, when they just get married, they're like super sexually active, right? That can absolutely cause problems in those people, right? So the biggest risk factor for UTIs, especially in a young sexually active female, is sexual intercourse itself, right? And again, if you see a child with a UTI, if a child is less than, because I know there's like all these resources that use all these different cutoffs and whatever, but if you see a child less than 2 years old and they have a UTI, you need to do a renal ultrasound first, and then after that you do a voiding cystourethrogram in those kids, right? Just to make sure they don't have any anatomic problems that is causing their UTI. You just want to make sure they don't have any anatomical problems causing their UTIs. And the thing with these kids is that when you see them, they keep getting these recurring UTIs. Those things, unfortunately, can cause like permanent renal damage. So to prevent that permanent renal damage from happening, one smart thing you can actually do is to just put them on daily antibiotic therapy, right? Daily antibiotic therapy. And also remember, if a woman gets UTIs a lot, like gets UTIs a lot, and you notice that it's associated with her having sex, then you can potentially put her on like just daily suppressive therapy, right? And one other thing you can also do is you can also just give like postcoital antibiotics. So daily suppressive therapy, postcoital antibiotics are perfectly fine in these women. It's something that's certainly pretty common in primary care, right? And when you're doing, because the thing is, most times adults are pretty good sample givers for UTI, if you want to diagnose a UTI. The thing is, in kids, if you're trying to make a diagnosis, kids are not very reliable, right? So there are some very specific criteria you need to know on MBM exams for the urine samples you're getting from kids. Remember, it needs to be a clean catch midstream sample, right? So what do I mean by midstream? So the child will start urinating, and then midway through their urination, as the urine is still flowing, you catch something. It has to be a clean catch specimen. Although many times, if the child is hospitalized, you can just do a urinary catheter and just draw out urine that way. So to wrap up, I will just talk about one weird thing you may see on your exam, right? They can give you a question about a patient. They tell you that, oh, this patient has had like, you know, dysuria, frequency, everything. And then they are taking an over-the-counter pill to help with the pain. And then they tell you that, oh, they've been taking this for like 3 days, and then they develop like perioral cyanosis, and, you know, they kind of short of breath and all those things. If you see this, I want you to think of methemoglobinemia from phenazopyridine, right? So azo, phenazopyridine, is spelled as phenazopyridine, phenazopyridine. It can actually cause methemoglobinemia. Because remember, normal hemoglobin has iron in the 2+ state. Methemoglobin is iron in the 3+ state. That's obviously not a great thing, right? Because iron in the 3+ state cannot bind to oxygen, right? So obviously in those circumstances, you're going to stop the azo, and you're going to give the person methylene blue and, you know, maybe vitamin C to fix their problems. Remember, vitamin C activates methemoglobin reductase as well, right? It makes it work better, so you can get Fe3+ back to Fe2+. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, again, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, step one, step two CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, 3-year clerkship shelf exams. I also offer, you know, these review courses, especially the 24-hour review course for step 2 CK and step 3, and the MBME test taking strategies course. And then I have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Spotify, at least the most recent 150. If you want everything from episode 1 all the way to this current episode, episode 356, just go on the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com. If you sign up with your WordPress account, then you can get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast. And then I have a YouTube channel. That's where I post my videos, Divine Intervention, USMLE podcasts and videos. And then I do have another website, divineinterventionlifelessons.com. In fact, it actually has a podcast associated with it. It's on Apple Podcasts. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. And I make like one or two podcasts a week that reflect on some life lesson that's pretty, you know, Bible-based teaching, kind of common to humanity, like a problem that many people face. I started a new series today, actually, on the law of sowing and reaping. So if that's something you're interested in, just go to that website. I have about 43 episodes right now, and it's going to keep growing every week. So have a wonderful Sunday. God bless you. I hope you really, really enjoy your day, and just, you know, stay warm, stay safe, wear your mask, get your vaccine, and I trust that all will be well with you. Thank you. Okay, bye.